Chapter 2. "I don't do cats," said Dirk gently. His tone was sharp. He felt he had come up in the world. He had no evidence to support this view. He just felt it was about time. He also had indigestion, but that had nothing whatever to do with it. The woman? What was her name? Melinda something. He had it written on a piece of paper somewhere, but had lost it, possibly under the pile of unopened bank statements on the far corner of his desk, was standing in front of his desk with her left eyebrow raised indignantly. "Your advertisement says..." "The advertisement is out of date," snapped Dirk. "I don't do cats." He waved her away and pretended to be busy with some paperwork. "Then what do you do?" she persisted. Dirk looked up curtly. He had taken against this woman as soon as she walked in. Not only had she caught him completely off guard, but she was also irritatingly beautiful. He didn't like beautiful women. They upset him with their grace, their charm, their utter loveliness, and their complete refusal to go out to dinner with him. He could tell the very instant this Melinda woman walked into the room that she wouldn't go out to dinner with him if he was the last man on earth and had a pink Cadillac convertible. So he decided to take preemptive action. If she was not going to go out to dinner with him, then she would not go out to dinner with him on his terms. "None of your business," he snapped. His gut gurgled painfully. She raised her other eyebrow as well. "Has the appointment I made with you caught you at a bad time?" "Yes," thought Dirk, though he didn't say it. It was one of the worst months he could remember. Business had been slow, but not merely slow. What was normally a trickle had first slowed to a dribble and then dried up completely. Nothing. Nobody. No work whatever, unless you included the batty old woman who had come in with a dog whose name she couldn't remember. She had suffered, she said, a minor blow to the head and had forgotten her dog's name, as a result of which he would not come when she called. Please could he find out what his name was? Normally she would ask her husband, she explained, only he had recently died bungee jumping, which he shouldn't have been doing at his age, only it was his 70th birthday, and he said he'd do exactly what he wanted, even if it killed him, which of course it did. And though she had of course tried contacting him through a medium, the only message she'd got from him was that he didn't believe in all this stupid spiritualist nonsense. It was all a damned fraud, which he thought was very rude of him, and certainly rather embarrassing for the medium, and so on. He had taken the job. This was what it had come to. He didn't say any of this, of course. He just gave the Melinda woman a cold look and said, "This is a respectable private investigation business. I..." "Respectable," she said, "or respected?" "What do you mean?" Dirk usually produced much sharper retorts than this, but as the woman said, she had caught him at a bad time. After a weekend dominated by the struggle to identify a dog, nothing at all had happened yesterday, except for one thing that had given him a very nasty turn and made him wonder if he was going mad. "Big difference," the Melinda woman continued. "Like the difference between something that's supposedly inflatable and something that's actually inflated. Between something that's supposedly unbreakable and something that will actually survive a good fling at the wall." "What?" said Dirk. "I mean that however respectable your business may be, if it was actually respected, you'd probably be able to afford a carpet, some paint on the walls, and maybe even another chair in here for a person to sit on." Dirk had no idea what had happened to the other chair in his office, but he certainly wasn't going to admit it. "You don't need a chair," he said. "I'm afraid you are here under a misapprehension. We have nothing to discuss. Good day to you, dear lady. I am not going to look for your lost cat."
"I didn't say it was a lost cat."
"I beg your pardon," said Dirk. "You distinctly..."
"I said it was a sort of lost cat. It's half lost."
Dirk looked at her expressionlessly. Apart from being extremely good-looking in a blondish, willowy-ish kind of way, she was dressed well in an I-don't-care-what-I-wear, just any old thing that's lying around kind of a way, which relies on being extremely careful about what you leave lying around. She was obviously pretty bright, probably had a pretty good job, like running some sort of major textile or telecommunications company, despite being clearly only 32. In other words, she was exactly the sort of person who didn't mislay cats, and certainly didn't go running off to pokey little private detective agencies if she did. He felt ill at ease. "Talk sense, please," he said sharply. "My time is valuable."
"Oh, yes? How valuable?"
She looked scornfully around his office. He had to admit to himself that it was grim, but he was damned if he was just going to sit there and take it. Just because he needed the work, needed the money, had nothing better to do with his time, there was no reason for anybody to think that he was at the beck and call of every good-looking woman who walked into his office offering to pay for his services. He felt humiliated. "I'm not talking about my scale of fees, though it is, I promise you, awesome. I was merely thinking of time passing, time that won't pass this way again." He leaned forward in a pointed manner.
Time is a finite entity, you know. Only about 4 billion years to go till the sun explodes. I know it seems like a lot now, but it will soon go if we just squander it on frivolous nonsense and small talk.
Small talk? This is half of my cat we're talking about.
Madam, I don't know who this we is that you are referring to, but listen. You may choose, when you've heard the details of this case, not to accept it, because it is, I admit, a little odd. But I made an appointment to see you on the basis of what it said in your advertisement, to wit that you find lost cats. And if you turn me down solely on the basis that you do not find lost cats, then I must remind you that there is such a thing as the Trades Descriptions Act. I can't remember exactly what it says, but I bet you £5 it says you can't do that.
Dirk sighed. He picked up a pencil and pulled a pad of paper towards him.
All right, he said. I'll take down the details of the case.
Thank you.
And then I'll turn it down.
That's your business.
The point I'm trying to make, said Dirk, is that it isn't.
So, what is this cat's name?
Gusty.
Gusty?
Yes, short for Gusty Winds.
Dirk looked at her.
I won't ask, he said.
You'll wish you had.
I'll be the judge of that. She shrugged. Male, said Dirk. Female?
Male.
Age?
4 years.
Description?
Well, that's a bit tricky.
How hard can a question be? What is he? Black? White? Ginger? Tabby?
Oh, Siamese.
Good, said Dirk, writing down Siamese. And when did you last see him?
About 3 minutes ago.
Dirk laid his pencil down and looked at her.
Maybe 4, in fact, she added.
Let me see if I understand you, said Dirk. You say you lost your cat, Gusty, while you've been standing here talking to me?
No, I lost him, or sort of half-lost him, 2 weeks ago. But I last saw him, which is what you asked, just before I came into your office. I just checked to see he was okay. Which he was. Well, sort of okay, if you can call it okay.
And, where was he, exactly when you checked to see that he was okay?
In his basket. Shall I bring him in? He's just out here.
She went out of the room and returned with a medium-sized wickerwork cat box. She put it down on Dirk's desk. Its contents mewed slightly. She closed the door behind her. Dirk frowned. Excuse me if I'm being a little obtuse, he said, looking round the basket at her. Tell me which bit of this I've got wrong. It seems to me that you are asking me if I will exercise my professional skills to search for, and if possible, find and return you a cat.
Yes.
Which you already have with you in a cat basket.
Well, that's right, up to a point.
And which point is that?
Have a look for yourself.
She slid out the metal rod which held the lid in place, reached into the basket, lifted out the cat, and put him down on Dirk's desk next to the basket. Dirk looked at it. It, Gusty, looked at him. There is a particular disdain with which Siamese cats regard you. Anyone who has accidentally walked in on the Queen cleaning her teeth will be familiar with this feeling. Gusty looked at Dirk and clearly found him reprehensible in some way. He turned away, yawned, stretched, groomed his whiskers briefly, licked down a small patch of ruffled fur, then leapt lightly off the table and started carefully to examine a splinter of floorboard, which he found to be far more interesting than Dirk. Dirk stared wordlessly at Gusty. Up to a point, Gusty looked exactly like a normal Siamese cat. Up to a point. The point up to which Gusty looked like a normal Siamese cat was his waist, which was marked by a narrow, cloudy, grey band.
The front half looks quite well, said Melinda, whatever her name was, in a small voice. Quite sleek and healthy, really.
And the back half, said Dirk,
is what I want you to look for.
Beyond the grey, cloudy band, there was nothing. The cat's body simply stopped dead in mid-air. Everything below, approximately the 9th rib, was, well, absent. The odd thing about this was that the cat seemed quite unaffected. This is not to suggest that it had learnt to live with its sad affliction, or that it was courageously making the best of things. It was, quite simply, unaffected. It didn't seem to notice. Not content with ignoring the normal requirements of biology, the cat was also in clear breach of the laws of physics. It moved, jumped, promenaded, sat, in exactly the same way as if its rear half had been present.
It isn't invisible, said Melinda, picking the cat up awkwardly. It's actually not there.
She passed her hand backwards and forwards through clear air, where the cat's hindquarters should have been. The cat twisted and turned in her grip, mewling crossly, then leapt nimbly to the ground and stalked about in an affronted manner.
"My, my," said Dirk, steepling his fingers under his chin. "That is odd.
You'll take the case?"
"No," said Dirk. He pushed the pad of paper away from him. "I'm sorry, but I just can't be doing with this sort of stuff. If there's anything I want less than to find a cat, it's to find half a cat."
"Suppose I was unfortunate enough to find it. What then? How am I supposed to go about sticking it on?
I'm sorry, but I'm through with cats, and I am definitely through with anything that even smacks of the supernatural or paranormal. I'm a rational being, and I..."
"Excuse me." The phone was ringing. Dirk answered it. He sighed. It was Thor, the ancient Norse god of thunder. Dirk knew immediately it was him from the long, portentous silence and the low grumblings of irritation, followed by strange, distant, bawling noises. Thor did not understand phones very well. He would usually stand 10 feet away and shout godlike commands at them. This worked surprisingly well as far as making the connection was concerned, but made actual conversation well-nigh impossible. Thor had moved in with an American girl of Dirk's acquaintance, and Dirk understood from the strange Icelandic proclamations echoing over the line that he, Dirk, was supposed to be turning up for tea that afternoon. Dirk said that, yes, he knew that, that he would be there at about 5, was looking forward to it, and would see him later. But Thor, of course, could hear none of this from where he was standing, and was beginning to get angry and shout a lot. Dirk had at last to give up, and hesitantly put the phone down, hoping that Thor would not do too much damage in Kate's small flat. She had, he knew, managed to persuade the big god to try to crush packets of crisps in his rages, rather than actual sofas and motorbikes, but it was sometimes touch and go when he really couldn't get the hang of what was going on. Dirk felt oppressed. He looked up.
"Oh, yes."
"No," he said, "go away. I can't deal with any more of this stuff."
"But, Mr. Gently, I hear you have something of a reputation in this area."
"And that's precisely what I want to get rid of, so please get out of here and take your bifurcated feline with you."
"Well, if that's your attitude..."
She picked up the cat basket and sauntered out. The half-cat made a pretty good fist of sauntering out as well. Dirk sat at his desk and simmered for a minute or two, wondering why he was so out of sorts today. Looking out of his window, he saw the extremely attractive and intriguing client he had just rudely turned away out of sheer grumpiness. She looked particularly gorgeous and alluring as she hurried across the road towards a black London taxicab. He hurried to the window and wrenched it up. He leant out.
"I suppose dinner's out of the question, then," he yelled.
Chapter 3
"You just missed Thor, I'm afraid," said Kate Schechter. "He suddenly went off in a fit of Nordic angst about something or other."
She waved a hand vaguely at the gaping, jagged hole in the window that overlooked Primrose Hill.
"Probably gone to the zoo to stare at the elks again. He'll turn up again in a few hours full of beer, remorse, and carrying a large pane of glass that won't fit. So he'll then get upset about that and break something else."
"We had a bit of a misunderstanding on the phone, I'm afraid," said Dirk, "but I don't really know how to avoid them."
"You can't," said Kate. "He's not a happy god. It's not his world. Never will be, either."
"So what are you going to do?"
"Oh, there's plenty to do. Just repairing things keeps me busy."
It wasn't what Dirk meant, but he realized she knew that and didn't probe. She went into the kitchen to fetch the tea at that point anyway. He subsided into an elderly armchair and peered around the small flat. He noticed that there was now quite a collection of books on Norse mythology stacked on Kate's desk, all sprouting numerous bookmarks and annotated record cards. She was obviously doing her best to master the situation. But one book, buried about 4 inches into the wall, and obviously flung there by superhuman force, gave some idea of the sort of difficulties she was up against.
"Don't even ask," she said, when she returned bearing tea. "Tell me what's going on with you instead."
"I did something this afternoon," he said, stirring the pale, sickly tea, and suddenly remembering that, of course, Americans had no idea how to make it, "that was incredibly stupid."
"I thought you seemed a bit grim."
"Probably the cause rather than the effect. I'd had an appalling week, plus I had indigestion, and I suppose it made me a bit..."
"Don't tell me. You met a very attractive and desirable woman, and were incredibly pompous and rude to her."
Dirk stared at her.
"How did you know that?" he breathed. "You do it all the time. You did it to me."
I did not, protested Dirk.
You certainly did.
No, no, no. I promise you, you...
Hang on, interrupted Dirk.
I remember now.
Hmm.
Interesting. And you're saying I do that all the time?
Maybe not all the time.
Presumably you have to get some sleep occasionally.
But you claim that typically I'm rude and pompous to attractive women.
He wrestled his way up out of the armchair and fished around in his pocket for a notebook.
I didn't mean you to get quite so serious about it. It's not exactly a major... Well, now I come to think about it, I suppose it probably is a major character flaw.
What are you doing?
Oh, just making a note.
The odd thing about being a private detective, you spend your time finding out little things about other people that nobody else knows, but then you discover that there are all sorts of things that everybody else knows about you, which you don't. For instance, did you know that I walk in an odd way? A kind of strutting waddle, someone described it as.
Yes, of course I do. Everybody who knows you knows that.
Except me, you see, said Dirk.
Now that I know, I've been trying to catch myself at it as I walk past shop windows.
Doesn't work, of course. All I ever see is myself frozen mid-stride with one foot in the air and gaping like a fish. Anyway, I'm drawing up a little list, to which I have now added, am always extremely rude and pompous to attractive women.
Dirk stood and looked at the note for a second or two.
You know, he said thoughtfully, that could explain an astonishing number of things.
Oh, come on, said Kate. You're taking this a bit literally. I just meant I've noticed that when you're not feeling good or you're on the spot in some way, you tend to get defensive. And that's when you... Are you writing all this down as well?
Of course. It's all useful stuff. I might end up mounting a full-scale investigation into myself. Damn all else to do, for the moment.
No work?
No, said Dirk gloomily.
Kate tried to give him a shrewd look, but he was staring out of the window.
And, is the fact that you don't have any work connected in any way to the fact that you were very rude to an attractive woman?
Just barging in like that, muttered Dirk half to himself.
Don't tell me, said Kate. She wanted you to look for a lost cat.
Oh, no, said Dirk. Not even as grand as that. Gone are the days when I used to have entire cats to look for.
What do you mean?
Dirk described the cat.
See what I have to contend with, he added.
Kate stared at him.
You're not serious.
I am, he said.
Half a cat?
Yes, just the back half.
I thought you said the front half.
Oh, no, she'd got that. That was there, all right. She only wanted me to look for the back half.
Stared thoughtfully at London from over the raised rim of his china teacup.
Kate looked at him suspiciously.
But isn't that, she said, very, very, very weird?
Dirk turned and faced her.
I would say, he declared, that it was the single most weird and extraordinary phenomenon I have witnessed in a lifetime of witnessing weird and extraordinary phenomena. Unfortunately, he added, turning away again, I wasn't in the mood for it.
What do you mean?
I had indigestion. I'm always bad-tempered when I've got indigestion.
And just because of that, you...
It was more than that. I'd lost the piece of paper, too.
What piece of paper?
That I wrote down her appointment on. Turned up under a pile of bank statements.
Which you never open or look at.
Dirk frowned and opened his notebook again.
Never open bank statements, he wrote thoughtfully.
So, when she arrived, he continued, after he'd put the book back in his pocket, I wasn't expecting her, so I wasn't in command of the situation, which meant that...
He fished out his notebook and wrote in it again.
Now what are you putting? Asked Kate.
Control freak, said Dirk. My first instinct was to make her sit down and then pretend to get on with something while I composed myself. I looked around and I noticed there wasn't a chair. God knows where it had gone. Which meant that she had to stand over me, which I also hate. That's when I turned really ratty.
He peered at his notebook again and flipped through it.
Strange convergence of tiny little events, don't you think?
What do you mean?
Well, here was a case of the most extraordinary kind. A beautiful, intelligent, and obviously well-off woman arrives and offers to pay me to investigate a phenomenon that challenges the very foundation of everything that we know about physics and biology, and I turn it down. Astonishing. Normally, you'd have to nail me to the floor to keep me away from a case like that. Unless, he added thoughtfully, waving his notebook slowly in the air, unless you knew me this well.
What are you suggesting?
Well, I don't know. The whole sequence of little obstacles would have been completely invisible except for one thing.
When I eventually found the piece of paper I had written her details on, the phone number was missing. The bottom of the sheet of paper had been torn off, so I have no easy way of finding her.
Well, you could try calling directory information.
What's her name?
Smith. Hopeless.
But don't you think it odd that the number had been torn off?
No, not really. If you want an honest answer.
People tear off scraps of paper the whole time.
I can see you're probably in a mood to construct some massive space-time-bending conspiracy theory out of it, but I suspect you just tore off a strip of paper to clean your ears out with.
You'd worry about space-time if you'd seen that cat.
Maybe you just need to get your contact lenses cleaned.
I don't wear contact lenses.
Maybe it's time you did.
Dirk sighed. I suppose there are times when my imaginings do get a little overwrought, he said. I've just had too little to do recently. Business has been so slow, I've been even reduced to looking up to see if they've got my number right in the yellow pages, and then calling it myself just to check it was working.
Kate?
Yes, Dirk?
You would tell me if you thought I was going mad or anything, wouldn't you?
Well, that's what friends are for.
Are they? Mused Dirk.
Are they?
You know, I've often wondered. The reason I ask is that when I phoned myself up...
Yes?
I answered.
Dirk, old friend, said Kate.
You need a rest.
I've had nothing but rest, grumbled Dirk.
In which case, you need something to do.
Yes, said Dirk, but what?
Kate sighed.
I can't tell you what to do, Dirk. No one can ever tell you anything. You never believe anything unless you've worked it out for yourself.
Said Dirk, opening his notebook again. Now that is an interesting one.
Chapter 4
Josh, said a voice in a kind of Swedish-Irish accent. Dirk ignored it. He unloaded his small bag of shopping into bits of his badly disfigured kitchen. It was mostly frozen pizza, so it mostly went into his small freezer cabinet, which was mostly filled with old, white, clenched things that he was now too frightened to try to identify.
Jude, said the Swedish-Irish voice. Don't make it bad, hummed Dirk to himself.
He turned on the radio for the 6 o'clock news. It featured mostly gloomy stuff. Pollution, disaster, civil war, famine, etc. And just as an added bonus, speculation as to whether the Earth was going to be hit by a giant comet or not.
Julian, said the Swedish-Irish voice tinnily.
Dirk shook his head, surely not. More on the comet story. There was a wide range of views about precisely what was going to happen. Some authorities said it was going to hit Sheridan, Wyoming, on the 17th of June. NASA scientists said it would burn up in the upper atmosphere and not reach the surface. A team of Indian astronomers said that it would miss the Earth altogether by several million miles before going on to plunge into the sun. The British authorities said it would do whatever the Americans said it would do.
Julio, said the voice.
No response. Dirk missed the next thing the radio said because of the noise of his front wall flapping. His front wall was made of large, thick sheets of polythene these days, because of an incident a few weeks earlier when, in a radical departure from the sort of behaviour that Dirk's neighbours like to see, a tornado jet fighter had exploded out of the front of Dirk's house and then plunged screaming into Finsbury. There was, of course, a perfectly logical explanation for this, and Dirk was tired of giving it. The reason that Dirk had had a tornado jet fighter in his hallway was that he hadn't known it was a tornado jet fighter. Of course he hadn't known it was a tornado jet fighter. As far as he was concerned, it was merely a large and bad-tempered eagle, which he had trapped in his hallway the same way anybody would, to stop it dive-bombing him the whole time. The reason that a large tornado jet fighter had, for a brief while, taken on the shape of an eagle was on account of an unfortunate airborne encounter with the thunder god Thor of legend, and this was the part of the story where Dirk usually had to struggle a little to sustain his audience's patient attention, which he would, if successful, further strain by explaining that the thunder god Thor had then thought better of his fit of temper and decided to put things right by returning it to its proper shape. Unfortunately, Thor, being a god, had his mind on higher, or at least other things, and hadn't called up, as any mere mortal might have done, to check if this was a convenient moment. He had just decreed it done, and it was done. Bang. Devastation. And also the insurance problem from hell. The insurance companies involved had all claimed that this was, by any reasonable standards, an act of God. But Dirk had argued, which God? Britain was constitutionally a Christian monotheistic state, and therefore any act of God
defined in a legal document, must refer to the Anglican chap in the stained glass, and not to some polytheistic thug from Norway, and so on. Meanwhile, Dirk's house, not an especially grand place to start with, was propped up with scaffolding and tented with polythene, and Dirk had no idea when he was going to be able to get it repaired. If the insurance company failed to pay up, which seemed increasingly likely in light of the strategy which insurance companies had adopted in recent years, of merely advertising their services rather than actually providing them, Dirk was going to have to, well, he didn't quite know what. He had no money. None of his own, at least. He had some of the bank's money, but how much, he had no idea.
Justin, intoned the little voice. There was no answering response.
Dirk tipped his unopened bank statements onto the kitchen table and stared at them with loathing. It seemed to him for a moment that the envelopes were vibrating slightly, and even that the whole of space and time was beginning to revolve slowly around them and get sucked into their event horizon, but he was probably imagining it.
Carl.
Nothing.
Carol.
Kier. Nothing. Nothing. Dirk made some coffee, taking the long route round his kitchen, in order to avoid coming too close to his bank statements, now that he had put them down. Viewed in a certain light, the entire structure of his adult life could be seen as a means of avoiding opening his bank statements. Someone else's bank statements, now that was a different matter. He was rarely happier than when poring over someone else's bank statements. He always found them to be rich in colour and narrative drive, particularly if he'd had to steam them open. But the prospect of opening his own gave him the screaming heebie-jeebies.
Keith,
said the voice, hopefully, nasally. Nothing.
Kelvin.
No. Dirk poured his coffee as slowly as he could, for he realized that the time had finally come. He had to open the statements and learn the worst. He selected the largest knife he could find and advanced on them threateningly.
Kendall.
Silence. In the end, he did it almost nonchalantly, with a sadistic little flick, slit movement. He quite enjoyed it, in fact, and even felt fashionably vicious. In a few seconds, the four envelopes, his financial history of the last 4 months, were open. Dirk laid their contents out before him.
Kendrick.
Nothing.
Kennedy.
The tinny little voice was beginning to get on Dirk's nerves. He glanced at the corner of the room. Two mournful eyes looked at him in silent bewilderment. As Dirk at last looked at the figures at the bottom of the last sheet of paper, a kind of swimmy feeling assailed him. He gasped, sharply. The table began to bend and sway. He felt as if the hands of fate had started kneading his shoulders. He had imagined it was bad. In fact, he had imagined little else, other than how bad it might be for the last few weeks. But even in his worst imaginings, he had no idea it might be that bad. Clammy things happened in his throat. He could not possibly be over £22,000 overdrawn. He pushed his chair back from the kitchen table and for a few moments just sat there, throbbing.
£22,000?
The word Kenneth floated mockingly through the room. As he rapidly cast his mind back over what he could remember of his expenditure over the last few weeks, an ill-considered shirt here, a reckless bun there, a wild weekend in the Isle of Wight, he realised that he must be right. He could not possibly be £22,000 overdrawn. He took a deep breath and looked at the figures once more. There it was again. £22,347.43. There must be some mistake. Some terrible, terrible mistake. The chances were, of course, that he had made it, and as he stared, trembling, at the paper, he realised quite suddenly that he had. He had been looking for a negative number, and had therefore assumed that that was what he was looking at. In fact, his account stood at £22,347.43, in credit.
Credit?
He'd never known such a thing. Didn't even know what it looked like. Hadn't recognised it. Slowly, carefully, almost as if the figures might fall off the page and get lost on the floor, he sifted through the sheets, one by one, to try and find out where on earth all this money had come from. Kenny, Kentigern, and Kermit slipped by unheard. It was immediately clear that it was regular amounts that had been coming in once a week. There had been 7 of them, so far. The most recent one had come in the Friday before last, which was as far as these statements went. The odd thing was that though the amounts were regular, they were for untidy amounts, similar each week, but not exactly the same. The previous Friday's payment was for £3,267.34. The previous Thursday's, they had each come in at the end of the week, 3 of them on a Thursday, 4 on a Friday, was for £3,232.57, and the week before it had been £3,319.14, and so on. Dirk stood up and took a deep breath. What the hell was going on? He felt that his whole world was spinning very slowly in what was, as far as he could judge, an anti-clockwise direction. That prompted a vague recollection that the last time he had drunk any tequila, it had made his world spin slowly in a clockwise direction. That was obviously what he needed if he was going to be able to think about this clearly. He rummaged hurriedly through a cupboard full of 9/10 empty bottles of half-forgotten rums and whiskies, and found some. A half-full bottle of mezcal. He poured himself a finger in the bottom of a teacup and hurriedly returned to his statements, suddenly panicking in case the figures vanished while he wasn't looking. They were still there. Irregularly large sums, regularly paid in. His head began to swim again. What were they? Interest payments that had been accidentally credited to the wrong account? If they were interest payments, that would account for the fluctuations in the amount. But it still didn't make sense, for the simple reason that over £3,000 interest a week represented the interest on £2 or £3 million, and was not the sort of thing that the owner of such an amount of money was going to allow to be misplaced, let alone for 7 weeks in a row. He took a pull on the mezcal. It marched around his mouth, waving its fists, waiting a moment or two, and then started to beat up his brain. He wasn't thinking rationally about this, he realized. The problem was that they were his own accounts, and he was used to reading other people's. Since they were his own, it was in fact possible for him just to phone up the bank and ask. Except, of course, they'd be closed now. And he had a horrible feeling that if he phoned them up, the response would be, "Whoops, sorry, wrong account. Thank you for bringing this error to our attention. How stupid of us to imagine that this money could possibly belong to you." Obviously, he had to try and work out where it was from before he asked the bank. In fact, he had to get the money out of the bank before he asked them. He probably had to get to Fiji or somewhere before he asked them. Except, suppose the money continued to come in? On reapplying his attention to the papers, he realized something else that would have occurred to him straight away if he hadn't been so flustered. There was, of course, a code next to each entry. The purpose of the code was to tell him what kind of entry it was. He looked the code up. Easy. Each payment had reached his account by international transfer. That would also account for the fluctuations. International exchange rates. If the same amount of a foreign currency was being transferred each week, then the variations in the rate would ensure a slightly differing amount actually arriving on each occasion. It would also explain why it didn't arrive on exactly the same day each week. Although it only took less than a second to make a computerized international transfer of money, the banks liked to make as much fuss as they possibly could about it so that the funds would swill around profitably in their system for a while. But which country were the payments coming from? And why?
"Kevin," said the Irish-Swedish voice.
"Kieran."
"Oh, shut up," shouted Dirk suddenly. That provoked a response. The small border terrier, lying perplexed in a basket in the corner of the room, looked up excitedly and yipped with pleasure. It had not reacted at all to any of the names which the elderly computer on the table next to it had been reciting from a text file of babies' names, but the creature obviously just enjoyed being told to shut up and was keen for more.
"Kimberly," said the computer.
"Nothing." The dog with no name looked disappointed.
"Kirby."
"Kirk."
The dog slowly settled back down into its basket of old newspapers and resumed its previous posture of baffled distress. Old newspapers. That was what Dirk needed. A couple of hours later, he had the answer. Or at least, some kind of an answer. Nothing that went as far as to make any kind of actual sense, but enough to make Dirk feel an encouraging surge of excitement. He had managed to unlock a part of the puzzle. How big a part, he didn't know. As yet, he had no idea how big a puzzle he was dealing with. No idea at all. He had collected a representative sample of the newspapers of the last few weeks, from under the dog, under the sofa, under his bed, scattered around the bathroom, and, crucially, had managed to secure two damp but vital copies of the Financial Times from an old tramp in return for a blanket, some cider, and a copy of The Origin of Consciousness in the Breakdown of the Bicameral Mind. An odd request, he thought, as he walked back from the tiny scrap of park, but probably no odder than his. He was constantly reminded of how startlingly different a place the world was when viewed from a point only 3 feet to the left. Using the figures from the papers, he was able to construct a map of the movements of each of the world's major currencies over the last few weeks, and see how they compared with the fluctuations in the amounts that had been paid into his account every week. The answer sprang into focus immediately. U.S. dollars. 5,000 of them, to be precise. If $5,000 had been transferred from the U.S. to the U.K. every week, then they would have arrived as more or less exactly the amounts that had been showing up in his account. Eureka! Time for a celebratory fridge raid. Dirk hunkered down in front of the TV with three slices of cold pizza and a can of beer, put on the radio as well, and also a ZZ Top CD. He needed to think. Someone was paying him $5,000 a week, and had been doing so for 7 weeks. This was astounding news. He ruminated on his pizza. Not only that, but he was being paid by someone in America. He took another bite, rich in cheese, pepperoni, spicy minced beef, anchovy and egg. He hadn't spent much time in America and didn't know anyone there, or indeed anyone else on the earth crust who would be wantonly shoveling unsolicited bucks at him like this. Another thought struck him, but this time it wasn't about the money. A ZZ Top song about TV dinners made him think for a moment about his pizza, and he looked at it with sudden puzzlement. Cheese, pepperoni, spicy minced beef, anchovy and egg? No wonder he'd had indigestion today. The other three slices were what he'd had for breakfast. It was a combination to which he, probably uniquely in all the world, was addicted, and which he had some months ago forsworn because his gut couldn't cope with it any more. He hadn't thought twice about it when he'd blundered across it in the fridge this morning, because it was exactly the sort of thing a person liked to find in a fridge. It hadn't occurred to him to ask who had put it there. But it hadn't been him. Slowly, disgustingly, he removed the half-chewed portion from his mouth. He didn't believe in the pizza fairy. He disposed of the half-masticated gungy bits and then examined the two remaining slices. There was nothing unusual or suspicious about them at all. It was exactly the pizza he had regularly used to eat until he made himself give it up. He phoned his local pizza restaurant and asked them if anybody else had been in to buy a pizza with that particular combination of toppings. "Oh, you're the bloke who has the gastriciana, are you?" said the pizza chef. "The what?" "It's what we call it." "No, mate. Nobody else has ever bought that wonderful combination, believe me." Dirk felt somewhat dissatisfied with aspects of this conversation, but he let it pass. He put the phone down thoughtfully. He felt that something very strange was going on, and he didn't know what. "No one knows anything." The words caught his attention, and he glanced up at the TV. A breezy Californian in the sort of Hawaiian shirt that could serve, if needed, as a distress signal, was standing in the bright sunshine and answering questions. Dirk quickly worked out about the approaching meteorite. He called the meteorite Toodlepip. "Toodlepip?" asked his interviewer, the BBC's California correspondent.
"Yeah. We call it Toodlepip because anything it hits, you could pretty much say goodbye to."
The Californian grinned.
"So you're saying it is going to hit?"
"I'm saying I don't know. Nobody knows."
"Well, the scientists at NASA are saying..."
"NASA," said the Californian genially, "is talking shit. They don't know. If we don't know, they sure as hell don't know. Here at Similarity Engines, we have the most powerful, massively parallel computers on Earth, so when I say we don't know, I know what I'm talking about. We know that we don't know, and we know why we don't know. NASA doesn't even know that."
The next item on the news was also from California, and was about a lobby group called Green Shoots, which was attracting a lot of support. Its view, and it was one which spoke to the battered psyches of many Americans, was that the world was much better able to take care of itself than we were, so there was no point in getting all worked up about it or trying to moderate our natural behaviour. "Don't worry," said their slogan, quoting the title of a popular song, "be happy." "Great balls of fire," thought Dirk to himself, quoting another. "Scientists in Australia," said someone on the radio,
are trying to teach kangaroos to speak.
Dirk decided that what he most needed was a good night's sleep.
End of side 5B.